And welcome to Beyond the Standard Model Physics. I assume everyone took Standard Model in the previous few weeks. So in this class, I will give you, we will try, Jun Wu is right there, he will teach the second half of this class. So we'll try to give you a general overview of what are the topics that the field of Beyond the Standard Model Physics deals with. So some of the things are not really en vogue right now, meaning they're not in fashion, okay? But I think we will, but I think it's very important to know where we have been, to know where we all go, so that you have a global picture of everything, what's going on, and how, when you have basic principles, when if you want to go ahead and work more in this field. So, in the context of starting from where we are now, is of course the Standard Model. And let's write down the particle content. There is the quarks that are triplets of SU3. Actually, let me start by writing the gauge. So the Standard Model has three gauge groups. There is SU3 color, there is SU2 left, and there is U1 hypercharge. There are, of course, the associated gauge couplings. And now the Standard Model particles have charges under them. So we have the quarks that are A3 under SU2, under SU3, A2 under SU2, and they have a charge of A6. We have the down type. We have the what usually I refer to as right-handed quarks, but I'm writing everything and in a left-handed notation. I'm assuming everything is left-handed spinner. So we have the right, the up-type quarks, and we have the dyne-type quarks. We have the following charges, 1/3. And then we have the leptons. They're not charged under color, they're doublets of SU2, have charge -1/2. And we have the right-handed electrons that have this type of charge assignment, so they only are only charged under hypercharge. And of course, there's the Higgs, which is the only scalar in our theory that has these quantum numbers. Now, I know it may be a slightly different charge notation than what you've seen in the past, but you can see that you can write, for example, the for up-type quarks, this is the Yukawa that you would write down. Okay, and I've put here cyclically an index because I goes from 1, 2, and 3 for the different families. Okay, I'm leaving out, of course, the gauge bosons associated with the gauge group. So we have the gluons that are basically there are 8 of them. We have the W and the Z bosons that are charged under SU2. And there is, of course, essentially the hypercharged gauge boson. This is W1, W2, W3, and there's the hypercharged gauge boson, or sometimes we call it B, which has, it's a single ladder everything. Okay, it carries no charge at all. Now, and this is what you should have learned so far, another very important thing to write down, and I'm going to write it down just to instill with you a very basic principle, is the masses. So we have the up-type quark that has a mass of 2 MeV. We have the charm, 1.3 GeV roughly. We have the top that has 173 GV of mass. And we have the down-type quark that has a mass of 5 MeV of the strange quark, 96 MeV, and we have the bottom, which was 4.2 GeV of mass. Then we have the mass of the electron. Who knows what the mass of the electron is? Okay, very important. Because of the mass of the electron, we take, it's important for our existence. So it's half an MeV, okay? And there is the muon mass, 105 MeV. And then there's the tau mass, which is roughly 1.8 GeV, okay? Why did I spend time writing these things down? I want to instill with you the following. This is what we know about the world, and it describes the world along with gravity to extreme precision, okay? But the thing about this is it's not pretty. Look at the masses, right? They're all over the place. It looks like there is one family of quarks and leptons that is kind of lightish. There's another one in the middle and the other is heavyish. So they span five orders of magnitude. I haven't written down the CKM matrix. You can Google it and see how ugly it is. It has three mixing angles, one phase. We have the three gauge couplings, okay? There is here, I need to add the mass of the Higgs, which is 125 GeV. There is also the web of the Higgs that breaks the SU2 left and hypercharge down to electromagnetism. And that's 245 GeV. Another parameter that is implicit here, and we always count it as a standard model, is gravity. So I need to write the Planck mass, which is 1.2 times 10 to 19 GeV. Okay. And there are other things I will actually go on more detail a bit later. So the standard model is not pretty, okay? It has roughly 20 parameters. I'm not even writing down the masses of the neutrinos, okay? Which is another 10 parameters. So a lot of the work for beyond the standard model physics is actually trying to understand this structure and trying to reduce, where do these parameters come from, okay? Another thing is related to hierarchies. So why is the Higgs mass so much smaller than the Planck mass? They're separated by 16 orders of magnitude, roughly. There is another parameter, actually, that many people add to the standard model. So there are these things. There is the cosmological constant, which determines how fast the universe is expanding. When you write it, it's roughly 120 orders of magnitude below the Planck mass. Okay? This is another hierarchy problem. So in all, we have something like 20 parameters plus 10, I'm adding the 10 parameters for neutrinos that we won't even touch in this class. So, and this has been an excruciating eons effort to get to here, okay? So now, what is it? I'm leaving out a lot of stuff here. What else am I missing out? Does this describe all the energy content of the universe? No. Okay? So this is only 5% of the energy content. So this beauty queen is 5% of energy budget. I think energy budget. Am I spelling this correctly? I think I am. 5%. So we have, to this we have 25% dark matter. Which we've only seen through the force of gravity, so we don't know what it is, okay? And the other, roughly 70%, is this lambda, which also we don't know where it's coming from, this number right here. So most of the stuff that the universe is made out of is made out of things that we actually have seen through the force of gravity, and we don't know where they're coming from. So in terms of just bookkeeping, the standard model is incomplete. Okay. Now, there is another thing about bookkeeping, is that when you look at this theory, and as you probably did in your standard model class, you see that for every standard model particle, there is an equivalent underparticle. You have the electron, you have the positron. Okay, you have muons, you have anti-muons. So the question is, where is all the dark, where is all the antimatter in the universe? So the fact that, so this theory, even though the CKM matrix has one CP violating phase, it's not enough to explain the fact that our universe is filled with matter and not equal amount of matter and antimatter. Okay? So this is what is known as, so this is, we start now, open questions. So we have contents of the cosmos. That's question number one. Other question is baryogenesis. So why is there only matter to the inside in the world? Okay. And as I said before, there are also questions that have to do with decomposing this beautiful structure. So the question is, where is flavor origin? So where does the structure of the quark and lepton masses come from? Is there an underlying theory and additional symmetries to it? Okay. Why three families is another question we don't understand. We just know to be a fact. Okay. The other thing has to do, so this is in some way, this is an aesthetics problem. The theory works just fine. We can take these parameters as given and move on. But it would be nice if there was additional symmetries, and we'll talk about that later. The other question has to do with hierarchy of scales. Okay. The flavor symmetry is part of that. You see here that starting from the mass of the electron all the way to the top mass, you have five orders of magnitude, okay, or almost six. So the question is, why are the quark masses spread so much? That's kind of like a hierarchy problem. Another hierarchy problem is that of the Higgs. Hierarchy problem. The extreme discrepancy between the Higgs mass and the Planck mass. And the other hierarchy problem that we have, and this is actually much more severe, as I will discuss about compared to the flavor problem. And there's another even bigger hierarchy between the cosmological constant scale, most of the energy that fills our universe, and the Planck scale. So this is something that we will discuss in this class. From all the topics, there is... there's another one that I will go more detail today that has to do with the gauge structure of the standard model. So why does it have a structure of 3-to-1? Okay, why these gauge groups? And this is a question that has arisen from the time that people realized that these are the gauge symmetries of the standard model. And the corresponding idea was, okay, can it be that this originates from the same gauge group? And this is what it goes by the idea of gauge coupling unification. Okay? Where do the gauge groups unify? And this is what we'll start by discussing today. There is another topic of BSM physics in general that we will not really touch upon the next few weeks. And that goes by the name of quantum gravity. Okay, because by default, we assume gravity is part of the standard model, and quantum gravity is something beyond the standard model that we will not go into, but it falls in the topics of these categories, okay? Any questions so far? I mean, this is mostly a review. So, before I talk about unification and how we can kind of reduce the structure of the standard model a bit more, we need to discuss a bit about units, okay? Today is a bit of an introduction. So, units, who knows fundamental units for particle physics? Have you seen them? Oh, someone nods, is nodding their head. You put yourself in a spot. So how do we measure meters in particle physics? In what units? Okay, you were just nodding. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. Okay, so in particle physics, we use a very weird but extremely convenient unit system. Okay? So in particle physics, h bar, the reduced Planck constant, the speed of light is 1. Okay? So what does that mean for things? It means that essentially everything is measured in units of energy. I notice here that I've already done this implicitly, because in principle here I needed to have divided by c squared to get mass in kilograms, but I wrote it down in GeV because they're equivalent. So the first thing to note, because of this, when you write E is equal to mc squared, it means that the mass is measured in units of energy. Okay? And you will see either EV or GeV. Many particle physicists used GeV because GeV is the unit mass of the proton. So we compare everything to the mass of the proton. Now, what is a second? So you remember from when you do light, energy, light, h bar omega, where omega is the radial frequency of the photon. So this means here omega has units of 1 over time. So if I take h bar to 1, it means the time has units of 1 over energy. Okay? And you can extract the relation between the second, what a second is, and a GeV through this relation. So you plug in h bar, the 10 to the minus 34, and then you see that if you do this little algebra, you will see that the second is roughly 1 GeV inverse is equal to 6.58 times 10 to the minus 25 seconds. Now, I know this is, it looks like a stupid way to write a second, but for particle physics, most of the time we deal for very short times and very short scales. So it's actually quite convenient when you look at particle physics processes to discuss in these units. Now, the other thing is that, so we set C to 1, which means that the dimensions of length are equal to the dimensions of time. So it means that they have to go like 1 over energy. Okay? And a very good mnemonic is that when you plug in the two numbers, is that h bar and c is equal to roughly 200 MeV times a femtometer. And I'm writing this way because 200 MeV is the scale of QCD, of the strong interactions, and femtometer is the size of the nucleus. So if I set h bar and c to 1, then you get a relation between energy and the meter. Okay? Now, you can play around with things. Now, what is angular momentum? What units does angular momentum have?
Meters.
Does it have any units? No, it doesn't. Yeah, it's constant, right? No units. It's dimensionless. Okay. What units does charge have? Unit charge is also dimensionless, and that you can see from Coulomb's law. So in Coulomb's law, the potential, let's say you have between two charges, goes like a squared over 4 pi in SI units, you have this epsilon naught, times 1 over r. Okay? So potential is always energy, right? It's interaction energy. So that has to be, has units of energy by definition. 1 over r, it's distance. So distance has units of 1 over energy, so 1 over distance has units of energy. So this means that in our way of describing things, the charge is dimensionless. And in fact, this is a number that is very well, very much used in QED, for example, when they put the fine structure constant, it's this number right here. And for the atom, it's 137. Okay? What units does acceleration have? Speak louder.
Energy.
Yeah, exactly. So acceleration has units of energy. What if, so if acceleration has units of energy, what does force have? What units does force have? Exactly. Okay. So this is just then you can define every quantity, the electric field, the magnetic field, energy densities, everything in terms of the units, okay? And this is not something that you haven't done before. So when we measure cosmological distances, you talk about light years, right? So instead of using meters, you're actually using time to measure distance there. So it's not uncommon to do this. So this is a good way to actually check also if you've done a calculation, if you've done it correctly, quickly, without having to track all the different factors and all the different units, okay? And I mean, you can play around with this. We can send you some little notes to see how one Newton transforms in these units. But I mean, we will, so as I've done implicitly when I wrote the quark masses down, it's so natural to us that we'll always put h bar in C to 1. Okay, unless I've explicitly said. Okay, good. So let me move this up. So this is basically some very basic introductory stuff. I'll put this up here to remind us, and then, okay, I'll figure this out eventually. So as I said, the first thing that we will be discussing today, the first of the BSM the BSM topics that we'll touch upon is unification. And the story, as I said, starts from the time the standard model was first discovered, that this is the gauge structure of the standard model. And in fact, there's a very nice paper by Georgi and Glashow. From 1974, okay? And that first discussed unification, okay? But, and this is something to read also for next time. But before we do that, so the idea that these people have is to take SU3 color and take SU2 left, and U1, and notice that this can be embedded in a single gauge group, okay, SU5. And this, in fact, is the most famous unification group that you will see. And now the question is, how do we do it? How do we unify the standard model? So, okay, you can see that, I mean, if you do, and we'll discuss this more, the gauge structure of SU5 contain all of these gauge groups, and there is some additional stuff. But if you have one gauge group, it means you have one gauge coupling. Okay? And we have three. And we know these three are different, right? We've measured them experimentally. So this is actually something that is extremely important for unification. We need to make these couplings equal. And how do we do that? That's the first obstacle that we have. So the question is, what is a particular property that that gauge couplings have that is actually a very quantum effect, if you want. When I told you that, when I said that the couplings are different, you should have asked me at what energies, okay? You know from QFT, we probably have done it, that gauge couplings run. It means that the value of these gauge couplings is energy dependent, okay? And the 137 that I wrote up there is in fact the value of the electromagnetic interactions at the energies of the atom. If you do experiments at the LHC, at much higher energies, at the mass, in particular at around the mass of the Z boson, which I didn't write before, it's roughly 90 GeV, you will see that the fine structure constant has a value of 1 over 128. So it has changed by roughly 10% between the EV range, when the atom operates, and the W and the Z mass. So again, that happens because gauge couplings run. And actually, this is going to be part of your homework. But I'm going to give you hints here. So when you write, this is a vertex for a gauge interaction, right? You have a fermion here, can be any standard model fermion, or can be a scalar, and this is the gauge boson. And this is what we call a three-level interaction, right? So the reason couplings run is because every time I have a three-level interaction, I need to add corrections to it. And this is the one-loop corrections, and there are more diagrams that you will see later. And if I call the scale, energy scale mu, of where the interaction happens, and this is a coupling G, I will find that the coupling G as a function of energy satisfies an equation that looks like this. This is B naught G cubed 16 pi squared, and this is at one loop, okay? Now, if you had, you can see that you can add other things in this diagram, like you can add things like this, that would be a two-loop diagram, right? So, but our loop, the evolution of the gauge couplings as a function of energy has a very simple form, and it looks like this. It is useful to write this equation the following way. So define a parameter T that is the log of the energy, and set X to be 16 pi squared G squared 4 pi over alpha. And this is, again, you see, you can write it as the inverse, fine structure constant of the corresponding interaction. And then the one loop equation becomes dx dt is equal minus 2b naught. Okay? It's a very simple equation. So it tells you that at one loop, And when you have weak coupling, right? Because one loop perturbation theory only works if the gauge couplings are small, okay? You find that x of t is equal to x naught minus 2 b naught t. So you see that what does it tell you? Tells you that the gauge couplings change logarithmically with energy. That's why the change of the fine structure constant at the scales where you have atomic experiments, which is 1 over 137, and at the Z mass, which is 1 over 128, is only 10% difference, because when you change logarithmically, it's a small change. Okay? This constant B naught depends on particle, on the particle content. Okay, so if B naught, and then you see that you have two cases. So this can divide the behavior of the gauge couplings in two categories. Okay, so one case is what we call IR free theories. And then when you plot x of t as a function of t, so this is higher energies right here. So this is UV, this is IR. You will see that it goes like this. Okay? So remember that this is like inverse coupling, okay? So this happens where B naught is larger than zero. So what does it mean for this quantity X to hit zero? Exactly. So you hit a lambda ball. Okay, so the theory becomes strongly coupled at high energies. And what happens at small energies? What does it mean? So if this becomes very large at small energies, what does the coupling do?
Speak.
Zero, right? So this is why we call it them IR free theories. So because if you go to very low energies and you have massless particles, then the theory becomes completely decoupled. Things don't interact anymore. Okay? An example of this theory is QED. And the way the law goes in QED, you have the, I saw you did it in two dimensions before, in the previous hour. You have the gauge boson, the photon, and then you have a charge. So the intuition that is actually after the fact developed is that as you go to lower energies, you create, some sort of quantum fluctuations of, if you have an electron, you create quantum fluctuations of positron that screen the charge. So you don't have any more long-range interactions. Okay? But as I will explain is after the fact. Okay? So this is case one. Now, there's another very interesting case, and it's the opposite, it's UV free theories. It's UV free theories, or as they are known, asymptotically free. Has anyone heard of asymptotic freedom before? Yeah, QFT too, yeah. So this is a very important thing. So that happens in the opposite case, where you have the inverse coupling as a function of energy, and where you have something like this, okay? So the theory at very high energies
it becomes completely decoupled. While at low energies, you see at some point, you cross zero, and again you get strong coupling. So this happens when B0 is less than zero. And the most famous example of this is QCD, the SQ3 of the standard model. Okay? The SQ3 gauge symmetry of the standard model is unbroken. But because the coupling becomes very strong at low energies, you cannot have freely propagating quarks and gluons. So they have to be confined to neutral color neutral states.
Okay? And I will try to give you some intuition about what happens in a bit.
Now, a very important point about this is that because the theory becomes free in the UV, you don't need to add new states to have a UV completion. It's just you have the same particles that just stop interacting, so your theory becomes trivial at high energies. And in fact, people, and this is what got people excited. So in 2004, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to Wilczek, Gross, and Politzer for calculating back in the 70s the fact that they and explain why QCD behaves the way it does, and given the first example of a theory that becomes UV-free. Till then, people just knew QED, or they knew the weak interactions. So those theories didn't have the property that QCD has. So it was a very important discovery in the way people understood the theory so far, and the way people understood field theory so far. So the question is, why is QCD so different? Okay? And in order to understand this, we need to look a bit at the structure of these constants. Okay? As I told you, the structure of these constants depends on B0, depends on the particle content of the theory. So if you have an SUN, a Young-Mills theory, pure Young-Mills, okay, without any fermions, let's not add any fermions for the moment, you find that this constant, just the gauge bosons, is given by this funny factor, minus 11 thirds, C2, the adjoint. So C2 is the Casimir, the quadratic Casimir, if you've done field theory, and you'll do it, I mean, it will be in your homework, so I won't tell you. It's a property that has to do with a leap the properties of the SUN. And the adjoint, and it's the quadratic Casimir for the gauge bosons of the SUN, because that's the only particles you have in the theory so far. So you see here that the gauge bosons give you a minus sign. So this is positive, this is a positive number. So you see that in Young-Mills, and in fact, in Young-Mills, this is just N, okay? And so you see that, so you see that it adds with a minus sign. Okay, and I will discuss what that means even more. But now let's add matter. So if you add matter, for example, let's add a fundamental, any sort of matter in a representation R. If it's a scalar, you will see that B0 is equal to 1/3. Some number TR, which is another form of Casimir. This is just, these are things that are determined by the Lie group algebra. So so if it's a fundamental of the SUN or an anti-fundamental, this is a half. If it's, for example, if you just have a U1, this T, Q, will be just Q squared.
you see here that the key point of this, that this constant for all representations, if you have a fermion, sorry, if you have a fermion, this T3, B naught is equal to 2/3. There is a factor, an additional factor of 2 if you have a fermion. But the key point is that this is always a positive sign. Okay? So matter fields, interacting particles, not the gauge bosons, push you in this category, in the IR-free theory. Okay? Always want to make you IR-free. While gauge bosons push you in the opposite way. And the key point is that in the standard model, in the SU3 of the standard model, you don't have enough matter content to have 8 gauge bosons, right? You have a lot of gauge bosons. You don't have enough matter content to counteract the effects of the adjoint. Okay? So that's why SU3 is asymptotically free, while any other group on the standard model is not. Another intuition, and this is again after the fact. After the fact, when people realize that this funny behavior happens for QCD, they were after the fact, they developed all sorts of intuition. They said, well, when you have an SUN, the gauge bosons carry charge of that SUN. Right? So because if they are massless, they spread the field of the interaction. So when you set up a 1 over R potential, it means that everything is charged. So if you go to smaller and smaller distances, you see less and less of that charge. So, but that is again after the fact, because this behavior was not at all obvious. Okay? So in your homework, you will be given all these. You'll play around with this, with particle content, with different representations to see what's happening, what is the behavior. But now you see an even bigger obstacle to unification. You have 3 different gauge groups. And in principle, these constants are different for each of the gauge groups. So in order for things to unify, okay, so you have, let's say, we have the x of t again, and you have as a function of the energy. So in order to unify, you need to make, so this is usually SU3, then let's say SU2, this is the U1, usually the weakest. You need to make 3 lines up to a point at some higher energy, which we usually call m dot. And this is highly non-trivial. If you know anything about geometry, you can make, 2 lines that are not parallel will meet eventually, but 3 lines meeting at the same point is a highly non-trivial statement. Okay? And in order for you to unify, there is a requirement on the beta functions. Okay? So what we do in experiments, we take, okay, this is measured in G3. We know from experiment the value of the gauge couplings at a certain energy. We know G3 at certain energy, we know G2 at certain energy, and we know G1 at certain energies. So now we can take the 3 couplings, the 2 couplings, sorry, see where they meet. And then with a given particle content of our choice, it can even be the standard model if so you wish. So you take, let me write this again. So you measure the 2 couplings, take G3, take G2, and they meet at a point, and then you run down, you do the inverse, you predict what the value of G1 is at low energies. So now you can go and compare against your data. Do I have unification or not? Let me write you down because, here, let me just lift this. Oh no, this is not. So, So there is a requirement. The fact that you need to have these things happen, three lines meeting at a point, there is a requirement in the relation between the gauge couplings and this constant B naught, the running of the gauge couplings, okay? So so I will be calling SU33, SU22, and U11, so 3-1 for the gauge couplings. So you find that so this is the ratio of the difference of the inverse couplings at a certain energy. This is the difference 1-2 and 3-2. Okay. This is 1-2. Okay. So it tells you that if you want these three couplings to unify for sure at a certain scale, you need the beta function running to satisfy this relation. Okay? So this is kind of what constrains your particle content. Now you can also predict, tell you what scales you unify at. And you find that the energy scale of unification, V not one, so again, by doing the game where you take two, you run them, see where they unify, you can get a prediction of what the scale of unification should be. And this is where the gauge group of the standard model becomes bigger. Any questions?
In presence of matter, the B naught is positive for SUN?
Yes. So for matter, it turns out, and it's not, as I told you, this is intuition people developed after the fact. For matter, it always adds up positively to B naught. Always. Doesn't matter what the representation is.
So why are quarks confined then?
So quarks are confined because the contribution from the gauge bosons, the gluons, is bigger. Okay, and that confines them at low. That causes them to confine at low energies. And that's a good question. It's just a balancing act, and this is why something you will play around in your homework. Actually, this is your tutorial, right? So you will see that in your tutorial that. So for SU2, this doesn't happen because SU2 doesn't have enough gauge bosons. It's a smaller rank group than SU3, right? So it doesn't happen. So SU2 is not enough to confine, but it's also broken. That's another issue. But for the quarks, the key point is that you have so many gluons that the fact that you have so many quarks is not enough. Okay? Yeah.
How sensitive is that particular plot to perturbation theory? So if I compute, do I in principle need to compute all orders?
Oh, good. No. So if you have, that's a good question. So so gauge couplings at energies that you measure at the LHC are small. And so when you run them up, unless you add extremely large contents of matter, when you run them at high energies, they still remain weak. They still remain small. So when you calculate the two-loop effects, for example, there are 1% correction to whatever you find here. So you don't have to go to very high loop. It is important, though, when you start doing precision predictions, right? Because, so as I showed you here, actually, this is a very good question. And so you hear, as I told you, okay, you measure the interaction of the quarks at LHC energies. Okay, you measure the weak interactions at LHC energies, you see, you'd run them up based on whatever standard model, okay? And then you run it down, and you to see, get with the prediction that you get for the other coupling. Now, at LHC, at colliders, now we've measured quantities to better than percent. So then if you know the meeting point, now you need to know the meeting point to comparable to percentage precision. So these things start matter when you start want to make predictions. And we will talk more about this also next time, but and you will see it also in your homework that in the standard model, actually, this doesn't happen. So in the standard model, if you run the couplings with the particle content that we know of, if you keep the things like that, what is up there, the lines don't unify. You have basically what you see is like, I mean, it's like this. Okay? And the funny thing is that wasn't always the case. Back in the 80s, when they first put down SU5 and they found the standard model, they hadn't measured the coupling so precisely. So if you don't measure things very precisely within error bars, you can unify. Okay? So people back in the 80s, actually, they were super excited about this. Because they had measured things to order one and roughly with a particle contest. There was a higher George I paper that we'll talk more about next time. People were ecstatic. Oh my God, there is 3-1 and then it unifies to SU5. And then we'll talk about experiments that they did. So we're super excited. Come 10 years later at LEP, which is the electron-positron electron-positron collider at CERN, in the 90s, where they measured these quantities to percent level, like, sorry, doesn't work. Guess what works though? Supersymmetry. And we'll come back to that, okay? So people got people excited, this whole thing got people excited. In fact, it's great that you asked, because in fact, this unification business is not about just putting things in right representation and making things fit nicely. You need to compare it against data. And so we'll talk about more about SU5 next time. And Susie, not yet, but you will see it in your homework how things change. So yeah, that's an excellent question. Okay.
You mentioned something about matter content of universe, how these couplings are sensitive to matter content. Like,
yeah.
What is the, I mean, if we want unification, how should we change the matter content?
Good. So turns out that, so, okay, there is an interesting fact that, first of all, dark matter does not contribute to the story. I haven't talked about dark matter at all. Okay? Let's leave dark matter out of it, right? So the key point here, I lowered and I hit it, okay. I'm gonna figure this out eventually. Okay, so you see here, as I told you, these are kind of relations that tell you what are the requirements on the values of the gauge coupling and the matter content so that they unify, okay? So you need to add, so in the standard model, you do it as an exercise, you'll see that these one loop beta functions do unify, do not unify. But you need to add different contribution to these things to make the ratio go the way you want, okay? And this is where things like SUSY comes in. Turns out that the minimum thing you need to unify to a very good approximation is fermionic patterns of the Higgs, okay? And this is, I mean, I don't want to spoil your homework. You will play around with this because that's the only way you learn. So you need to add new stuff to the standard model to make it work, okay? And you need stuff that's charged under the standard model because something that is not charged will not change the story, all right? Okay? Yeah.
How correct is it to build these grand unified modules without having gravity? Because when we go to very high energies, the masses increase and then...
That's an excellent point. Okay, good. So this is where people got... That's an excellent question because people... And we can discuss that gravity is weird, right? Gravity doesn't run the way... So gauge couplings, the interactions are marginal, so they run logarithmically with energy. Gravity is completely different. Gravity, the higher energy you go... The gauge coupling, if you want, the gauge coupling of gravity, and I put it in quotes because goes like energy over M Planck. Okay? So it becomes strongly coupled at the Planck scale. But at energies, so now at energies, let's say factor of 10 below the Planck scale. This is a tenth. Now it starts becoming similar to the other gauge couplings, because if you write down dimensions of the gauge coupling, you see that charge of the electron, for example, is 0.3. So the big idea, and this is where also string theory comes in, is that so when you calculate what the unification scale, what I call MGAT, you see that for supersymmetric theories, not for the standard model so much, this is roughly 10 to the 16 GeV, which is very close to the Planck scale. So people said, oh, given that it's so close to the Planck scale, then I can even imagine that gravity unifies with the Southern forces as well. But this is a much more, I mean, and also given that gravity is so weak and the energies are so high, it's hard to make concrete predictions. You cannot play the same game you do with a particle content to get of the standard model that you can check, because this is actually, so when they discovered that unification works with supersymmetry, this is what makes supersymmetry extremely popular. Because they said, hey, we have a data point. It tells us that we need to look for these particles at these energies. But they didn't find them, okay? But they had a good reason to say, well, I have a theoretical prediction that tells me the particle should be roughly here. You cannot play the same game as here with gravity. So that's why people kind of like, okay, let's push the lift the rug, put gravity under there, and just kind of like close our eyes and not worry about it. Yeah, but this is an excellent question, and it will come up. Like, gravity is always a funny business. And we'll talk more about gravity, especially when it comes to the hierarchy problem. So, again, excellent question. That's it? Everyone understood everything. That's fantastic. good. So for next time, sorry.
What is the energy difference between non-dot point QED and the unification?
Sorry, I didn't hear you very well.
What is the energy difference between the non-dot point for the QED case and the unification?
Oh, for here, the lambda ball for these guys? Oh, that's an answer. No, the lambda ball you hit above the Planck scale. It's very high. Yeah, that's an excellent thing. Yeah, it's very high. It's above the Planck scale. So this is where gravity will come in and mess everything up before you hit the lambda ball for the SU2 and the U1. Yeah, good question. For the standard model particle content, right? Because I can add whatever I want and change this running of these couplings, right? But assuming you have the standard model particle content all the way to high energies, that lambda ball is above the Planck mass. So gravity, you'll have to deal with quantum gravity before you deal with that lambda ball. Okay.
If this running coupling doesn't depend on the energy scale monotonically, like, what is the motivation that we're saying that, like, I understand that we can calculate it to the loop of Monte Carlo and QCD and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
Dependence is monotonic, but can it help if like it won't be monotonic, like not completely increasing?
You could have other. You could have other. Yes, so we'll talk about. So part of the things that we'll discuss when hierarchy problem comes. When you have, there are these theories that explain the large extra dimensions and that explain the hierarchy problem. You don't have to know what they are. But then gauge couplings start behaving like gravity. And gravity, as I told you, the coupling runs with the energy. So coupling squared depends on energy squared. So it runs very fast. It runs with a very funny power. So there you can change the way unification works. But always, the key point is trying to get a prediction out of it. And that's one thing, to get the gauge couplings to work. The other thing that you need to be mindful of is, okay, you fit the standard model in here,
But how do you break this gauge group that you unify to get to the standard model particles? You don't want to get random things, okay? And this is what we will discuss more of next time, okay? But yeah, in principle, you can play games like that. But in a way, this is the simplest thing. That's the thing I want to, I mean, the way people get excited is also, as I will explain this next time, this is the simplest thing people could imagine doing. And staying in four dimensions, don't go in other dimensions so that you make the running cup differently.
Could we have two unification scale if like...
Oh God, people have played with that. It's hard to do. And then you add a lot of particles and... Yes, people have played with that. So for example, people have even built models because particle theories can go berserk sometimes. So they build models where the QCD is strong at the weak scales, but then comes back to be strong again. So you had this nice thing where it was a UV-free, and then you didn't have to deal with anything, and then you just make it strong again. Yeah, you can play games like that. Yeah. Good. Yeah?
If the SU5 theory is true, then how's decoupling runs after the
energy? It runs with the SU5 running, so this B0 will change. So because the particle content will depend what particle content you need at the SU5 scales. And I mean, you can add a lot of stuff. I mean, you can easily imagine it's also asymptotically free, like SU3. But it depends on the particle content you add. And we'll talk about that particle content next time, Friday. Good. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you, guys.